September 30th and October 1st at the Cinema 21 at 616 Northwest 21st. The show starts at 7 o'clock. There'll be a question and answer panel after the show with Elaine and me and many of the farmers, including Dory Robinson and some urban till staff who are coming up from coming up from Richmond for the Wednesday night screening. And then Thursday, there'll be another screening. We also, you can go to our website, which is www.mediaprojectonline.org, and there's a lot of information there.
Well, I've been telling everybody about the film. I hope people go. So thank you for being on Health Watch today.
Thanks, David.
Thank you so much.
We are talking today to Elaine Velasquez and Barbara Bernstein about their latest film, Gaining Ground. You've been listening to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host.
Buffalo herd, you can't roller skate in a buffalo herd. You can't roller skate in a buffalo herd, but you can be happy if you've mind to.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Buffalo Field Campaign 2015 Roadshow, hosted Wednesday, September 23rd at 7 p.m. at Bison Coffee House in Portland. The event will feature stories and songs about the last wild buffalo and information about the ongoing struggle to protect them. That's the Buffalo Field Campaign 2015 Roadshow, Wednesday, September 23rd, 7 p.m. at the Bison Coffee House, 3941 Northeast Cully Boulevard in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You can't roller skate in the buffalo herd. You can't roller skate in the buffalo herd.
You're listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO Radio 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. I'm Doug McVeigh. Recently, the Federal Bureau of Justice Statistics released its annual report on the nation's prison population, prisoners in 2014. According to BJS, at the end of 2014, there were more than 1.5 million people held in state and federal prisons in the U.S., over 210,000 in federal prisons and more than 1.35 million in state prisons. That's an imprisonment rate of 471 people per 100,000 population. Notice I said imprisonment rate, not incarceration rate. There are more than 700,000 people held in jails in the U.S., for a total of more than 2.2 million people behind bars. The incarceration rate in the United States is about 700 people per 100,000 population. That's the highest incarceration rate in the entire world. That's one reason why overcriminalization and mass incarceration in the United States has become such a major concern in the past few years. It wasn't always this way. In 1980, a total of 305,458 people were being held in state prisons in the United States. Federal prisons that year held another 24,363. Then came the Reagan era. Democrats and Republicans at the federal level and in the states began a bidding war to see who could appear to be tougher on crime. By 1990, a total of 708,383 people were being held in state prisons in the U.S. Federal prisons held another 65,526. By 2000, state prisons held nearly 1.2 million people, and the federal prison system had grown to hold more than 140,000. The federal prison population went over 200,000 by the end of 2009. At which point, another 1.3 million people were held in state prisons. To get a handle on all these numbers and how we got here, I spoke with Mark Maurer. Mark is the executive director of the Sentencing Project. He's been working on these issues for the past few decades, educating the public and policymakers about mass incarceration and advocating for reforms.
Well, the numbers look at the number of people in prison at the end of 2014. What they show is that there's been a 1% decline from the previous year. in the number of people incarcerated. And to put some perspective on it, there are about 2.2 million Americans behind bars in our prisons and jails right now. This is nearly seven times as many people as were locked up back in 1970, just before this trend towards mass incarceration began. So many of us welcome this very modest decline, but it comes in the face of nearly four decades of a record prison expansion.
Now, has the federal prison population also leveled off, or is it continuing its rise? Obviously, the report deals with both state and federal.
Yeah. In the most recent year, the federal prison population has declined actually for the second year in a row. Previously, it had been rising at even a faster rate than the state prison population. I think it's fair to say if we look over the last decade or so, the numbers overall have increased, but much less so than in the heyday of the war on drugs, tough on crime of the 1980s and 1990s when we saw double-digit increases in some of those years.
Now, the state numbers? Let's go back to those for just a moment. I know that California has been one of the states leading the way, largely because they've been ordered by the courts to reduce their prison population. Do you think this is a real trend, a continuing trend? Are states starting to run out of ideas for how to, I mean, they've been throwing people into jails rather than prisons to bring the number in prisons down. Actually, let me back up for a moment. Could you just quickly, for the benefit of my listeners, explain the difference between the jail and prison? I mean, as you said, this counts the number of prisoners, but the number of jail inmates is a different report.
Yeah. Well, two-thirds of the people behind bars in the United States are in prison, state or federal prisons, where people are serving time for a felony conviction that sends them away for more than a year. About a third of the population behind bars nationally is in local jails. And this consists of people who've been arrested and are awaiting trial but haven't been released on bail, or people serving relatively short sentences for misdemeanors or felonies of less than a year. And both these populations, prison and jail, have risen dramatically over the last 40 years.
Now, in terms of the different kinds of violations, people like to think that prisons are where we put very dangerous offenders. Obviously, the war on drugs turned that upside down, and so we got a lot of nonviolent folks. What's the basic proportion? What percent of the people inside are in on drug violations? And if you could even further talk about the trends, how we're doing there.
Yeah. Well, if we look at the prisons, it's a very different picture between federal prisons and state prisons. The federal prisons are much smaller. They hold about 15% of the total prison population, but half the people in federal prisons are there for a drug offense, and a very small proportion are there for a violent offense. And this reflects the sort of ramped up nature of the war on drugs and federal prosecutions over the last 30 years or so. In state prisons, the numbers are substantial, but much less than federal. So today, about one of every six people in state prison is incarcerated for a drug offense. And these proportions have actually been declining somewhat in the last several years or so, partly because we've seen the success of some diversion programs, treatment rather than incarceration. In some cases, judges are much less inclined to put people in prison if substance abuse is the underlying problem. So the numbers are still huge, but they're not rising at the level that they were not that long ago.
Now, let's talk for a moment about overcrowding, because it would be one thing if we had sufficient room to hold all these people who've been sentenced, but that's not really the case in the federal or in a lot of the states. How are we doing as far as overcrowding?
Well, overcrowding is still a terrible problem in virtually every prison system in the country. That's what led the Supreme Court to declare the entire California prison system unconstitutional because the level of crowding meant that they could not provide adequate health care to inmates. And the Supreme Court ordered the state to reduce its prison population by more than 30,000 people over the last several years. So some of those people are now housed in local jails. Many of them are being supervised in local communities. But we see this around the country, and it means that the conditions of confinement, which were never good to begin with, are now even more challenging, both for prisoners and for the guards. It means that the programming in prison, which has been limited as well, now there's essentially more competition for slots in programming. So whatever the reasons are we send people to prison, you know, the prospect of people changing themselves for the better while they're there, is just increasingly difficult all around.
I know that you've been working on these issues for quite some time. Your book, Race to Incarcerate, is over here on my bookshelf. It has an honored place. Can you talk to me for a moment about some of the racial disparities that we are seeing in prisons currently?
Well, we see enormous racial disparities. African Americans are incarcerated at a rate about six times that of whites. Latinos, about 2.5 times the rate of whites. If you break it down by race, age, gender, for black males in their 30s, about one of every 10 is in a prison or jail on any given day. One in 10 prison or jail. Just remarkable. You know, and as we know, suppose these figures were that one in 10 white men in his 30s were in prison or jail. I think we'd have, you know, the President of the United States and members of Congress say this is a national emergency. We need to do something about this terrible problem. How can we solve this problem? We would see action very quickly.
Now, how do you think I hate to ask people to prognosticate, but what the heck? I've got you here. We do seem to see some momentum at the federal level. The states have also been talking about reducing prison populations, getting these under control. What kind of potential do you see for real change in sentencing law, for instance, over the next, over the next year or so? Now Congress is back. There are bills on both the House and Senate side. Do you think they have any potential, or how long? I mean, obviously we're in this for the long haul, but do you think?
We're at a moment right now when there's really an opportunity to make a difference in our sentencing policies. Over the last 5 years or so, we've seen liberals and conservatives coming together to critique the drug war, to critique excessive sentencing policies, excessive punishment when it's not necessary for public safety. 5 years ago, Congress passed a reform to the crack cocaine mandatory sentencing laws, reducing the disparity between crack and powder cocaine offenses. This year, there's significant activity in the U.S. Senate. Senator Grassley of Iowa, who chairs the Judiciary Committee, has announced that essentially any day now he will introduce a bipartisan package that will affect federal sentencing and federal prison programming. We'll see what that looks like, but we're encouraged that we're seeing this level of activity. A number of states have also enacted sort of a reconsideration of mandatory sentencing, of drug policy sentencing, really rethinking that we shouldn't be proud of the fact that we have a world record prison population in the United States.
Again, let's go back to the states for a moment. And can you tell me what states seem to be starting to get it right? Obviously, California is under a court order to try and be, you know, imaginative. What about the states that aren't being pushed by the federal courts?
Well, we see the state levels that there's tremendous variation among them in what's been happening over the last decade or so. There are a handful of states, California, New York, New Jersey, Rhode Island, that have reduced their prison populations by about 25% or more over the last 10 or 15 years. So that's a fairly significant decline, and they've generally done it both through changes in sentencing policy, but also in how they they make decisions. So how do they decide what charges to bring, when to use mandatory sentencing or not, when to use diversion programs, what happens when somebody tests positive for drugs when they're out on parole or probation? Do you send them back to prison or just revise the conditions of their supervision? So there's some very significant shifts going on. At the other end of the scale, states like Arkansas, Louisiana, still seeing rises in their prison populations that were already dramatically high to begin with. So overall, it's really a situation of relative stability in the population, but I think the handful of states that have achieved these significant reductions show us that, yes, you can reduce these prison populations. There's been no adverse effect on public safety. Their crime rates continue to decline, even though there are fewer people behind bars. And it helps us to sort of reshape that whole conversation about incarceration and crime.
That was an interview with Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project. This is Political Perspectives on KBOO Radio 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. I'm Doug McVeigh. Jason Zeidenberg is the Director of Research and Policy for the Justice Policy Institute. He's been studying U.S. criminal justice policy and practices for about the past 15 years. He's also worked within the system in both Washington, D.C. and here in Multnomah County. We spoke by phone about these numbers and the human cost they represent.
So, you know, for the 1% that is now back in the community that wouldn't have been there before, or the, you know, the 5,000 fewer federal prisoners that seem to be driving that, this is good news for them. For the growing movement of people that are concerned about the overuse of incarceration, the fact that we're spending $80 billion plus to lock people up, the fact that people are serving too long in prison, this isn't great news. I think in particular, we've had such a good year of being able to engage a whole new group of people, particularly on the right, that are interested in reducing the prison population, and have said so, at least rhetorically. The fact that we've only seen a 1% drop is actually concerning to me. With the crime drop that we've seen over the last decade and a half, we should be seeing a bigger drop in the number of people locked up. What this says to me is we have a lot more work to do to make the case to the public and policymakers that we need to be bringing down prison populations, changing laws, changing practice, and finding ways to keep people out of prisons and jails.
Now, the states, California, of course, has been under a federal court order to try and reduce its prison population. One way they've been doing that has been to simply shunt people over into the jail system because jails are recorded separately. Have other states been using that sort of, innovation is a wrong word. Let's say an end run in order to try and reduce their populations.
I think the California situation speaks to a couple of different things. It speaks to how complicated a game it's going to be to bring down the prison population, particularly at the state level. What you do see in California on the positive side is that on a county-by-county basis, some counties are not choosing to build more or bigger jails and not choosing to lock up more people. But it's very true that there's been a overall growth in jail expansion in California, which has really meant that we haven't seen the drop in the incarcerated population there that we would have thought we would have seen. It means that we have to engage at multiple levels. The federal courts that, you know, are overseeing the California case, the California legislature, where there are a group of legislators that play a role in blocking the changes in laws that we really need to see. And then there's also a need to engage at the county level and the city level to pull whatever levers we can pull there to keep people out of the system. So for your listeners in Portland, Oregon, that would include engaging with even the city of Portland around how policing practices lead people to be arrested, to be brought to the jail, to the county commission, which is actually figuring out better ways of reinvesting some of their dollars in the community, to the state legislature that is ultimately responsible for the statute. That's what I think the California example speaks to a bit. We need to be hitting this on all levels.
Let's go for a moment to the to private prisons. I know that's something that you've been working on, an issue you've been working on for a very long time. We saw a slight decrease in the number of inmates in private prison facilities. Still, the number has grown rapidly. Could you speak to me for a moment about the issue of private prisons?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one way of looking at it is the total number of people in private prisons has grown by 90% from 99 to 2014. So 131,000 people now in a private prison bed. We would like to see fewer people locked up in both public prisons and private prisons, where the private prisons are a significant problem is it creates a for-profit interest that, you know, would be engaged in keeping these prison populations up. And we have a report on our website called Gaming the System, which gets into deeper details on this relationship between the private companies and how they engage with policymakers to artificially keep prison populations up. It's a problem. It's a very concerning problem. It's as concerning as the fact that a 1% decline in the prison population is not going to really make a dent in the mass incarceration problem we're facing in this country.
And now for a moment, let's switch over to prison overcrowding, because that is that's one of the reasons used for the introduction of private prisons. It's the reason that the federal courts have ordered California to try and cut down on its populations. A lot of states have problems with overcrowding. Tell us how serious is this as a problem?
Well, it's serious on two levels. First of all, there's something like 18 states in the federal government are operating at more than 100% of their maximum prison capacity. So that's just the scale of the problem. It's a problem for people in prison because it means we're exposing them to conditions that are going to make it more likely that they're going to have challenges when they get out, not less likely. It creates safety problems within these facilities. And it's just a leading indicator of, okay, what are we doing in policy, practice, and law that's leading so many people to be behind bars for so long? It's a sign that we're not making the progress here that we need to be making.
Now, regarding racial disparities, because that's a problem that's pervasive throughout the criminal justice system, and when it comes to the prison end, it just keeps getting worse. Now, in their new report, BJS notes that compared to violent and property offenders, inmates serving time for drug offenses in state prisons showed little racial disparity. The idea being that there are roughly equal percentages of white, black, and Hispanic state prisoners sentenced for drug offenses. Obviously, it's a huge problem generally. Now, speak to me for a moment about some of the racial disparity issues and how we can start addressing these.
Well, let's take this apart, though, a little bit. First of all, there is racial disparity in the number of people ending up in prison and jail for a variety of offenses, and the offense breakdown only captures their most serious offense at the time that they went in. So we know from the literature that there's a group of people that engage in property offenses, even some of the more violent offenses that are defined by the statute as violent, whose underlying problem is a drug or public health problem. Could be a mental health problem, could be a co-occurring challenge that they have. So I think it underestimates, you know, the scale of the role that drugs play when we just focus in on that one small snapshot of the population. I'm moved by the fact that about 60% of the whole prison population is still African-American and Latino or Hispanic. I think that's a troubling picture for us. To the degree that that looks like it's changed, part of that is we're getting better and a little bit better in some of these systems at disaggregating whites from Latinos in the actual counts. There are still states in which they say there's nobody Latino in prison, even though we've got plenty of information that would say the otherwise. The racial and ethnic disparities are a huge issue in what the impact of prison is to a community. And the fact that it's having this concentrated impact, particularly in the African-American community, but not just, is something we're going to be reaping real policy problems from in the future. We know that being in prison makes it harder for you to get a job, makes it harder for you to connect to work, makes it harder for you to connect to housing, makes it harder for you to navigate multiple systems when you return to the community. The fact that this is having such a concentrated impact in relatively small part of our community, the African-American community, should be a real concern and should really take away from any celebration we might have that we might have seen a 1% decline in the overall prison population.
Now, of course, turning from race to gender, 1% drop in the total, a 1.2% drop from last year in the number of men who are under the jurisdiction of state or federal correctional authorities. But according to the report, a 1.4% increase in the number of women who are behind bars. And that's that continues a long-term trend. What's happening there?
So I think there's a couple of important things to talk about when we're talking about women in prison. First of all, even though they represent statistically a smaller portion of the overall population in prison, the collateral impact when we incarcerate a woman is much larger for the whole community. It means that a young person may have lost a parent to prison, their primary parent, primary caregiver. In some ways, it's more expensive to incarcerate a woman than it is a man. And we think, you know, I've not studied the trends in great detail, but certainly that there's been a lot happening around drug enforcement and human trafficking that may be leading more women to be ending up in the prison system. I think it's a worrisome thing on multiple levels, particularly the fact that it's going to cost our communities even more when we remove a woman from being the role that they would play in our community.
Now, of course, this report mostly deals with adults in the U.S. correctional system, in the prisons, state and federal. But we also have juvenile offenders who are being put through the adult system. Can you speak to me a moment about the juvenile justice system and the spillover into the adult system?
Well, I think what's really interesting about this report that looks at the what's happening on adult prison population trends is that we've seen more progress on the juvenile side, where we actually have seen the number of kids being placed out of the home or confined, which are the equivalents of being sent to prison for a juvenile, really declined by significant numbers. We saw something like 100,000 young people placed out of the home and confined about 10 years ago, and now it's down to about 50,000. So that is good news. We've also seen closures of juvenile facilities around the country. I think this has to do with the fact that we've really been able to press policymakers around it just costs too much, it's not making us safer, it's not treating people fairly, and because of that, policymakers have made some significant changes on the juvenile side. We need to see those same changes really take hold on the adult side. Otherwise, we're going to continue to talk about things like 1% declines, and we're not going to see the progress that would really ease up the burden of spending $80+ billion on our correction system.
That was Jason Zeidenberg, Director of Research and Policy for the Justice Policy Institute. You can learn more about these issues by going to the Sentencing Project website at sentencingproject.org and the Justice Policy Institute's website at justicepolicy.org. There's also a website called drugwarfacts.org, which compiles all these data. For now, this is Political Perspectives on KBOO Radio 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. I'm Doug McVeigh. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for listening to the Monday Morning Radio Zine here on KBOO. If you can just stand by here for a moment, here we go to the noon headlines, followed by the Noontime Jamboree today. Gary's here for the Noontime Jamboree, so keep your dial right where it is. KBOO Portland.
And now the KBOO News at noon for Monday, September 21st, 2015. In local news, the Metro Regional Government has scheduled three public hearings on the upcoming vote on whether to expand the urban growth boundary. State law requires the Metro Region to have a 20-year supply of land available to meet projected population growth. A majority of the Metro Policy Advisory Committee and the Metro CEO, Martha Bennett, have all come out against expanding the urban growth boundary. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales is also against expanding the urban growth boundary, saying most future growth will occur in Portland and new demographics show a majority want to or will be forced to live in large apartment buildings as Portland is currently building en masse. All those who have come out on record as wanting to expand the urban growth boundary were from Clackamas or Washington County. The Oregon Department of Transportation has issued a new report on the safety of Oregon bridges. The study found that at least half of the state's nearly 2,800 bridges need to be repaired or replaced within the next 5 years. It is estimated that the repairs would cost at least $240 million per year to accomplish, but this year's budget contains less than 25% of the needed funds. In regional news, an archaeological survey dig at a construction site in Seattle has uncovered thousands of stone tools dating back at least 10,000 years. The site also unearthed traces of several different types of food on the tools. Chemical analysis of the food particles on the stone tools revealed that Puget Sound tribes at the time were eating bison, deer, bear, sheep, and salmon. The site is believed to be a camp used to make and repair the stone tools the local tribes used in their daily lives. The site is located on Bear Creek near the Redmond Town Center Mall. After the state of Washington is finished analyzing the 10,000-year-old tools, they will be handed back to the Muscle